Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
History 605. Today on the show, we've got a couple of guests. We're glad to welcome back to the show both of them, David Grabitsky, who's the Assistant Director of the Historical Society and Director of the Museum. And joining him, also a second-time guest, is Dan Mulkley, who is the Curator of Exhibits. David and Dan, welcome to History 605.
Glad to be here, Janet.
I wanted to have you on this show. And first off, I think we should note the occasion. This is the 100th episode of History 605. So we hit that century milestone and the end of season 5. So this has been kind of fun. And both of you guys have been on before to talk about various museum exhibits and work on the renovation to the Cultural Heritage Center, those projects. And so it's glad to have you back on and hit the 100th milestone together. So
yeah,
thanks.
We're honored to be marking this auspicious occasion, simply because the museum started off the year by marking the 100th session of the legislature, and here we are marking the 100th episode of your show.
Yeah, it's time for century marks, I guess. 100th session of the legislature. We had a number of issues that we worked through and did with them, and Dan was largely the energy and the creative work behind the exhibits down in the Capitol. So if you came to the Capitol last year during the legislative session and into the summer, you would have seen those exhibits about the legislature marking its 100th session. So, yeah, we're all about hundreds here on the show today. I wanted to take the episode today and update people on the work in the museum. The Cultural Heritage Center has been through a renovation, which included adding more space for both public events and storage of both museum artifacts and archival records. And we've moved back in the spring of this year. But museum work has continued. And we've gone through a process of design and work and conceptual development, and now architectural plans and writing of the text and script that will accompany the interpretation of the chosen artifacts. All of it's been a lot of intellectual work and a lot of historic heavy lifting, a lot of curation, a lot of advisement. It's involved many people, and it's involved a kind of a roadshow that we took around the state. So it's been quite an involved process over the past few years. I wanted to bring people up to date on what we've been doing. So thanks, gentlemen, for joining me on the show, and let's get into it. I wonder if we could, before we talk about what's coming, since this is a history podcast, let's talk about the past, previous history of the museum. David and Dan, when you first saw the museum, what was your kind of first impressions of the previous exhibits?
Well, I really think the exhibit that had been there was very well done and very striking. I enjoyed it a lot. There was kind of an implied order of things that it might have been in a chronology, although I know it was not created that way. The exhibit itself was a product of its time and had text embedded right into the fixtures, which my guess would have been very hard to update.
Well, for those people who visited us in the past, or for those who haven't had the pleasure of seeing those exhibits, the gallery was really divided up into four areas. So we had the temporary gallery, which was then called the Hogan Gallery. That was an annual rotating exhibit. So you could see anything in there from 1970s to textiles to Minuteman missiles, right?
Yeah.
And then the sort of permanent gallery was divided up into three exhibits. And as David indicated, they were somewhat chronological. I mean, I think that some of them did sort of transcend some time frames, but for the most part, you know, the ways of the people was the American Indian history mm-hmm. of South Dakota, followed by proving up as you circle the ring of galleries was homesteading, and then changing times brought it up to current times, roughly speaking, historically yeah. speaking.
I suppose that's late 20th century. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be one of the things that we talked about on my very first day was looking at that kind of layout and saying, well, history continues to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking at the way those galleries were laid out, do we just sort of line up the whole team on the end of the gallery and start pushing, and we can just squish everything down, right? Make right. some space for the history from the last 40 or 50 years.
Right.
And so I think that that was one of the takeaways from our very first meeting, which was my very first day on site working yeah. in this job, was those first meetings. So,
and that first meeting was with Split Rock, which at that time, I think that was pre their current contract, but they were brought on as an advisor. Split Rock, in its previous corporate form, was the designer for this very museum. South Dakota hired them back in the 90s to help develop the exhibit designs at that time. And so they're still very active across the country, but primarily in the Great Plains and Midwest, doing museum work and museum design. And they kind of took us through our paces that day about big questions. For instance, what are the stories you want to tell? Who is the audience? These things are tough to discern. And then kind of the technical details, how do you maintain the best museum over time? And how do we build a museum that avoids this problem you just talked about, Dan, which was, you know, we're not going to get any more square footage. So without adding on certain square foot per year or something, how do we squeeze more history into the same space? And how do we adapt the stories as descriptions and questions, new questions emerge, new evidence emerges, new collections come in. We collect, as you know, we collect new artifacts every month. We get new things. And so how was all that done? So we kind of walked through a lot of things that day and over the next several days.
Just as a quick backtrack for the people who didn't have the pleasure of viewing those galleries, or for people looking for a reminiscence hit, you can check out all of the previous exhibits on the museum's website.
That's right.
So we did take 360 photographs of mm-hmm. the exhibits, although we were already in the process of depopulating. And we have assembled those into virtual tours that people can go through and take. And we, I believe we even have most of the media, the different videos and the different audio available there that people can see and hear. So it's right. kind of nice. And we are a history museum. We track our own history.
That's right. We track our own history, both as an organization, but also within down to the collections, certainly.
I was going to mention that or support your statement that we collect history as it happens. As a history organization, we're not sitting around scratching our head wondering what happened in 1854. We collected it at the time. Sometimes things like that do come up, but you know, this last summer, the very first South Dakotan was ever drafted in the National Hockey League. We reached out to the family and were able to obtain an object that tells his story and will be here for the next 100, 200 years for people to come back and visit.
That's right. We're constantly doing that. So given that constant collection and that history never stops, or as you say, David, often history keeps piling up, physically in artifacts at the door, or as the story emerges with more and more artifacts or different things that give us the opportunity to tell different stories, we have to kind of create some flexibility. And so I remember in a lot of these conversations, Dan in particular, you saying we have to build something that can swap out artifacts. And I wonder if you could just chat about the kind of the technical aspects of curating a working museum once it's open and running. And what are the things you wanted to design into that to allow that to happen?
Sure. So I think that, you know, you hit a lot of the kind of key considerations there in the introduction and just now, in that history is different from the past, right? And so as history is a process of asking questions, and over time, the questions that we ask, it's continually changing, and new evidence coming to light. And so when designing an exhibit, it is very difficult at times to look at things chronologically. And I think that that's why I was so pleased to see us go with more themes as a system of organization in this exhibit. It gives us the opportunity to, not only when we get a new artifact in that speaks to something, a particular topic, or when we start asking new questions, to be able to approach that particular space. Mm-hmm. And rather than trying to shoehorn it in to a chronology, you know, a lot of things also happen over time. You might ask a question about homesteading and not, oh, that was a single point in time. Well, there were a lot of different steps and a lot of different bills and a lot of different developments that happened over 30, 40, 50 years. And so where do you put that on a chronological timeline? Do you talk about homesteading with immigration? And so then where do we talk about immigration that's, you know, happening in the 2000s?
Right.
And so looking at that and thinking about how that works, having things sorted by theme or by topic gives you the ability to approach so many square feet and say, what are my artifacts? What are my questions that I'm asking? What are the stories that we can tell? And then as things become more significant down the road, we can look at switching the stories in those square feet, providing people with a historical view that takes into account the most recent knowledge that people have brought to attention.
I think one of the things that impressed me years ago, I was visiting a museum, and they had just put up a military exhibit, and they had this nice chronology of military events, the Civil War, the Plains, the Spanish-American War and World War I, et cetera. And it went all the way up to the present, and was standing there with the director and talking to her, and she was very pleased with that exhibit. And there was a gentleman that was looking at the exhibit, and finally he came over to us and he said, "This is a very nice exhibit, but where's my war?" And she said, she made the mistake of saying, "Well, we have all the wars." And he said, "Well, I fought in Grenada." So that wasn't highlighted for him. But if you think about the experience that those that go into the service have, they had a time before the service, they had an induction, they had different events that happened in the mess hall, basic training. These are events that are timeless, and you can talk about veterans from any period through that lens. And so that's why I think the going to a thematic or a topical way of presenting history is going to be a more effective one, because we can include those other stories.
Right. It provides a lot of options. Of course, the concern that we had at the time, and maybe I was more vocal about this than others, was that I was concerned that the visitor to the museum might feel a little off in their own. You know, as you go from one topic to another, what's the bridge? How do they connect to that? But I think we've found a way to keep that front and center while working through it. So anyway, that was a healthy discussion, and we came up with, let's go on to the themes then, and a couple of them have already come up. I think Dan, you alluded to this history and the past and the difference between that. I wonder if you want to explain that or David chime in on that.
That is part of basically what I consider to be the introduction to the new gallery, is to make that bold statement right away and mm-hmm. tell people it's okay that we see history changing. History, whether it be the history books in classrooms or the history that you see in museums. The past is static. It happened. It doesn't change, and we'll never fully know about it. But we can ask questions and learn about it and be able to write stories about the things that happened in the past. And so, yeah, that concept is tackled front and center. And that was a discussion. I think that was one of your comments in that first meeting, and I was just like, wow, this is great. Because first of all, it's a big cultural discussion mm-hmm. that people can have within their families right then and there. They can talk about, well, this is what I learned about in school, and what are you learning in school? Right. Grandparents can ask their grandkids, and then they can look in that area and see, oh, historians consult documents. And so we have a documents mm-hmm. expert talking to people about how to use documents in historical research, photographs, artifacts, oral traditions, archaeology. You know, these big subjects are broke down. And how right. do we ask questions of these things? How do we learn about that past that is so distant and alien to us? It's a foreign country, right? The mm-hmm. past. Getting people to be able to address the past in terms of how we learn about it is a big goal, and it yeah. serves people as they go all the way through. And in a sense, letting people have that freedom, you said sending people through alone, it isn't necessarily all bad. We're giving them the space in the new gallery to pick up the information and make some conclusions and ask some new questions, and then they right. can take a few steps right over to the archives and start asking,
right.
How do I ask, what topics, what sources do I have to research this particular?
Right.
And that was one of our goals, to drive people into the collection and the process of doing history.
So this has now resulted in our conceptual and the design and the text, and the things are laid out in the gallery we're calling What is History, where people can come in and ask that question and respond to certain things. There'll be the layout's very visual, and there's a lot of kind of high, or I should say prominent artifacts that would prompt questions, and a lot of photographs that should prompt questions and make people think about how all these very different people in South Dakota's history are connected or not. You know, they can remain very diverse and at the same time share the different geographic space. Somebody several months ago asked me, what's the most interesting thing about South Dakota's history? And I said, well, one thing is you can have Laura Ingalls Wilder and Black Elk be contemporaries, very different people, very different cultures. And they lived at the same time in the same state. And she didn't quite know what to do with that. Which is good. I think it really kind of slowed her down, that the person who was asking me that question, and she didn't kind of. So that's the kind of thing we want people to kind of take a slow down and compare and contrast and think about how to ask questions of the past.
And that was something you brought up in that initial meeting, was that you wanted to be able to help people ask those questions, to teach mm-hmm. them to ask good questions of history and take a look at things. And then I think that came home to me when we first saw the design schematics and so forth. And there was a picture of Russell Means next to Wild Bill Hickok. And yeah. he just laughed out loud and said, two men with long hair and very different visions for South Dakota.
Right. Very different visions for South Dakota, but yeah, the same barber. Or not the same barber, but the same hairstyle. So, but yeah, in one vision, they were sitting right next to each other. I don't know if they still are, but they enter that same space. I think that So there'll be that opportunity in that first exhibit, or that this is Area B. I guess we'll stick to that. So that's Area B. Then another main thing that came through in our conversations were the environment and the weather. And other aspects in our conversations and concepts were that South Dakota is a welcoming place. And so we wanted to take lessons learned from that proving up exhibit and think about how the area was settled by Americans in the 18th century, 19th century, and 20th century, and the waves of immigrants that have happened really in one way, shape, or form in the past 10,000 years, maybe further back. And then we wanted to get into mining, gaming, tourism, and military service. That was another thing that I think came out that we wanted to do that. And then, of course, we needed to deal in a very honest and sincere way with the clash of cultures of European Americans and American Indians. And so all of those issues have their own kind of dedicated space. And maybe we can work through a little bit there with how Split Rock first came back with some of these. Split Rock meaning the exhibit contractor, the design of these spaces. So square footage being what it is, namely not endless, we had to kind of make decisions on how much space we needed to do. And obviously the biggest gallery is going to be the environment. Dan, I wonder how have you approached using the state museum's current collection into telling the story of South Dakota's environment?
Well, I think that Area C, which is a challenging environment, it's about a third of our total gallery space. The museum's collection is really set up for telling that story. The collection going from, you know, the very first items coming in up to what we're still collecting, mm-hmm. speak to the topics of that space, which are humans have come to South Dakota, as you said, from 10, 20,000 years ago, all the way mm-hmm. to people coming today. Not only have we all shaped that natural environment, but that natural environment shapes us. And so mm-hmm. it really speaks to our identity. And I know we talked about how do South Dakotans identify, how do we see ourselves, and the concept of talking about things in terms of East River, West River, and then, you know, the river section of the state being kind of its own little space, and looking at, you know, what are those environments like, and what are the challenges, and what are the adaptations that different people over centuries have used to make this their home, and mm-hmm. the idea of laying out the premises, who are the people, what are they doing, what is the natural environment like, and what did they think about it, and how did they learn about it, is the big push in that area. I think the most difficult part was I worked with David Hartley, who was a former museum director, mm-hmm. and brought him on to the exhibits advisory group, which we met probably a dozen or so times over my first 3 years here. And one of our very first sessions, he said, "Dan, I just want to apologize." And I said, "For what?" "Well, when you do an exhibit, you really want to show the best things you've got in your collection. And so I'm really sorry that we showed all the things that were the best things in the collection, and we did it for 20 years. And so implied in that was kind of like, so we're sorry, there's nothing left new to show. And I was just like, well, no, don't worry about this. This is great. What I found is that the collection has a deep bench. And yeah. so we're able to dig in there. And by asking some different questions, as is appropriate, we're mm-hmm. able to find the right items to pull to get the story across. I think the only real sticky point was, you know, we kind of came into that design process as well with, here are 10 objects that we must have on exhibit, because, you know, these things are quite large, and and we need to have them on exhibit so that we have the appropriate storage space for them. You know, that being like a wagon, which is great, the Landau,
the teepee,
the teepee, you know, the Dodge automobile.
Yeah.
You know, but these things are indicative. They have a broad and interpretive value, and they really did serve as anchors then for defining the space and gave us something to build around, which is kind of crucial. Whenever you're doing a creative process, it is always about hitting those, that first draft just as soon as you can, and getting those particular points that are going to become the anchors for the rest of your work in position. And so those anchors were even a benefit.
Yeah, I think those anchors are a good way of saying that there's going to be a lot new in the gallery, but there are going to be some familiar old things too. The best of the best, we always got great comments on Milking the Cow. All that interactive will be back.
Yeah, kids love it. Parents love it. That that dairy exhibit was great.
It's great. Agriculture still important in South Dakota?
I'm told it is. Yes.
I'm told so, yes.
Well, and that goes to how the land is used and how it's been adapted and so forth. So we could see, you know, I've often said in previous podcasts and so forth that people have come to South Dakota for thousands of years to hunt. And hunting has changed a great deal, but we still get people to come to South Dakota to go hunting, whether it's elk or bison or pheasant or whatever the case may be. And that changing use of the environment tells the story. And that's the kind of the story we wanted to tell about that since all the way back to the end of the last ice age, I think. Well, you've mentioned too, you just mentioned David Hartley. I wonder if you wanted to kind of work through, we weren't all sitting in a room by ourselves thinking of all this. We had a lot of advice from a wide variety of different people. I wonder if you wanted to walk through the different kind of communities or groups that has assisted us and given us feedback on our thoughts and drafts along the way.
Well, we started off with Share Your Voice. So we took it out to people all across the state in 13 different communities and heard lots of different aspirations for what the new exhibit would be. Whether it was, for instance, in Timber Lake, they said, well, you need to make sure you have fossils. And that came up a couple other times in other places too. Other places were more specific to their region, such as the time we were in Watertown. They wanted to talk about prairie potholes. And that's certainly a major part, major feature of that part of the state. But the one thing that we did hear consistently, I think, across the state was how welcoming South Dakotans are, the hospitality that we show. And they really did encourage us to think about creating that first gallery as the welcome space for people who don't have a lot of time to spend, but they want to spend some quality time with us, whatever length of time that might happen to be, and see some of the greatest objects that we have in our collection. They'll be right there in the welcome area, and it reflects that desire to have a welcoming presence that reflects the values of the state. And I thought that was a very valuable contribution.
Yeah, I think I remember folks in Brookings and DeSmet and Timber Lake, certainly Hot Springs, that the welcoming aspect of things kept coming back up into the conversation. So, so gallery number one isn't where is history, like we had discussed just a few minutes ago. It's welcome to South Dakota kind of an aspect.
But then we also took the exhibit to other communities of that had some contributions to make, and we went to the academics, for example, to take a look at and make sure that our citations were good, and we're hitting all the highlights and so forth. And I think that contribution too was very effective. And
I think we corralled the folks who teach South Dakota history at the college level for the most part. There was American historians and South Dakota historians in that group, and we ran things past them and got some good advice and maybe a few vectors and some fresh ideas on some things that we had not thought about before. That was a very useful conversation.
And then Dan has taken us out to tribal advisement and language advisors. And
yeah, and in fact, as we're recording this, I'll just report I lament that with the weather going on here in our South Dakota December, back to talking about the environment, that our advisory process, I'll have to be working remote tomorrow. We were going to be making a trip out to Spearfish to continue our advisory process, but it's been a fairly robust process, I think, working with American Indian communities in South Dakota. We set up two different groups initially, and now we have our third group. As we go through all of the gallery space, our visitors will see that after Area C, we get into an area where we talk about the different ways in which the people have connected and collided over the resources that we lay out in Area C. As we go through that area, we try and discuss things from the perspectives of a number of different people, a number of different ways of viewing things, right? So we might not talk just about Hutterites, you know, their particular communities, their particular ways of doing things. It's different from ours. So they've got different questions, different things that they ask, and different things that they focus on. So we look at history not just from sort of a standard American perspective, pop culture, but we take a look and see, you know, what are these different cultures saying about things? So Hutterites, our modern immigrants, and our American Indian communities. So in working with American Indian advisory groups, it's been a great process. Going through those listening sessions that you mentioned, the 13 communities across South Dakota and our academic advisors, we grew a pretty large list of broad topics and specific stories to address. Mm-hmm. And so that's when, you know, in the process, we started sorting these things out and grouping them up. And then we were left with the question of how do we tell these stories from some of these different perspectives? Who can we talk to mm-hmm. understand their perspective, the history from their particular culture? And so we formed the cultural advisory group, who we went through and said, what are the most important things that we need to mention? What is the tone that we need to strike? Mm-hmm. How do we organize this? And we really let that group take the reins and direct us as to how to tell their story. And then the language advisory group brought another layer of depth to that. Because that right. now that group tended to be more people in their 70s and 80s who remember older times and who spoke with people who remember even further back mm-hmm. and had those lessons passed down through oral tradition, and bringing that next layer of depth to the topics at hand, where some of our academic advisors are reading secondary histories or looking at primary sources. And these right. people are, you know, people who either lived it or grew up with people who lived some of these things.
Right.
So bringing that right. perspective into the writing and right. the organization of material and a little bit of selection of material was crucial.
So now, brought a lot of background in how language carries history. You know, the UN talks about there being roughly 7,000 languages in the world and how we're going to lose about 90% by the year 2100. And every time you lose a language that carries history, you lose history. But they were able to tell us more about the meaning, the context behind the words that influenced the history, the things that the material culture that they used and so forth. That language piece, I thought, was one of the most important contributions right. that the entire exhibit had.
Well, yeah, and it's difficult to break that down. As you guys remember, we did a presentation on this at the annual history conference, and I think we went over our 45-minute time span just on this one topic. There are some, we'll do a quick plug. There are some very good topics and very good presentations at the history conference to break out some of these things.
Yeah, I got a kick out of that one. Not only does culture, language transmits history and culture, but also shares the perspective, because I got a kick out of how would you translate. And I think, Dan, you told the story of, we use the phrase East River and West River, but they don't translate directly into Lakota or Dakota. They would use it from the perspective of East River. And what was the, how would they say what would be west of the Missouri? What does it translate into?
My understanding is that, you know, when you meet someone in the Ochite Shakowin culture, first you say, you know, I'm Dan. This is my family. And now this is where I was born. And now there's a lot of information being passed in there, just in that first few words. So that, yeah, if I wanted to say East River, I'd say, and I lived in West River, I'd say, East River is the place where the people live who live on the other side of the river. And because you knew who I was and who my family is, you'd know that I'm from West River. And so when I say the people who live on the other side of the river, it's East River. Whereas if I told you who I was and I was from Yankton area, and I said the people who live on the other side of the river, of course, then it's in, you know, it's clear that I'm talking about West River. Right. And it is funny to us in that we have these specified terms. So there is really something about that as David was talking about, that so much of the past, so much history is carried in this very simple terms, the language that the people use. Yeah. It's been a very special getting to meet the people that I've met and work through some of the conceptual hard points of the stories that we're trying to tell. And also, you know, begging their forgiveness. As an exhibit designer, you learn early, you have to have thick skin. Because as I've told every advisor in every step of the process, odds are everyone in this room will be mad at me about something when this exhibit is done. And when it opens, everyone's going to be mad about something. The hope is that you find something that you can connect with, that you love, and probably more of that than the other, if that makes sense, right? Because there's so many perspectives and there's so many stories that happened in the past. So you grow that thick skin and listen and do the best you can.
Well, and one of the things I think you've helped us do, and that the American Indian Advisors, Language and Culture Advisors, has helped us do, is attend to a weakness that was in the previous exhibit that would give somebody the impression that American Indian history ended in 1890.
That's a crucial thing that was brought up in every one of the three steps of the advisory process with American Indians, and I think with the academic advisory group as well. Mm-hmm. In the previous exhibit, you came in, and the Ways of the People was a beautiful, beautiful exhibit. I mean, it had ambiance, it had artifacts, really high quality stuff. And they did a great job with their advisory process back then. That's actually where we started, by going back and reading the notes and providing the synopsis of those notes to our current advisors. But the limitation of the gallery in its past iteration was that you got that heavy dose of sort of 19th century American Indian story, and then you moved on into homesteading. Halfway through the gallery, we pick up the story of Wounded Knee, and then we go through the last half of the gallery, and there are code talkers. Well, that really gives the idea that their culture sort of stopped. It doesn't exist anymore. And that's why one of the points that we drove home is that the culture is active. You know, it's vibrant. It's having some real growth going on today. It's a dynamic. And, you know, one advisor said, make sure that this exhibit doesn't just portray us as people running around the prairies.
One of the things I wanted to see in this new exhibit is lessons of agency that the Lakota were doing things for themselves, things that they valued and saw as important, and they wanted to move their culture forward on their own. Right. That they just weren't being acted upon by the outside powers, that they too had their own way of going about things.
Right. And that doesn't stop. I mean, I think whether it's Red Cloud or Ben Rifle or Billy Mills, those stories will be told and in the museum because of that factor you just talked about, David, was the agency continues and so forth. And so, well, I think now given we want to wrap up here, what's the future look like then? We've kind of gone through the process of how we've put the museum together, some of the aspects that are in the museum and the design that people can look forward to, a bit of the, and by the way, they'll be interactives, both mechanical and electronic, that will draw people in of all ages in a constructive and participatory way. So what's the timeline? As we sit here recording this on the 2nd of December, we kind of hit a milestone this week, right, David?
Well, we started physical construction, the infrastructure in the gallery. We had a subcontractor in that laid out the floor plan. They put chalk on the floor and to fix it in place on the floor so that they would know where to build the walls and so forth. Mm-hmm. That was a spray paint, just a clear spray paint. And of course, that smell is heavily present right now in our lobby, but I'm assured that it will go away. They're building the physical part of the general contractor is putting up walls and conduit and so forth. They're expected to wrap up sometime. Their hard date is March 27th, okay. 2026. And then after that, our exhibit contractor, Split Rock, will come in and furnish out the temporary gallery and the first two exhibit halls, the welcome area and the what is history, and then the rest of it should open by the end of the year, certainly by the first of January of 2027.
So with the semi-quincentennial, with the we have the goal of opening up a temporary exhibit about South Dakota's perspective on the semi-quincentennial, America's 250th birthday.
Semi-quincentennial.
But that word just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? The semi-quincentennial, or America's 250th birthday, we'll have a temporary exhibit on that. And then galleries A and B, so the Welcome Gallery and the What is History Gallery. And we're shooting to be open on that 1 July. And then
of 26.
Of 26, yep. And then the rest of the galleries open by the end of the year. So that's the kind of phased plan. And we look forward to having a ribbon cutting and a big deal this July and welcoming people to the new museum where they can see and experience the history of the state in this new way. Very much looking forward to that.
And of course, you know that this is where the fun really begins then on January 1 of 27. That's when we start trying to roll out the artifact rotation to change out so that we give our artifacts time to rest so we can tell more stories.
Right.
And as we go through the advisory process with all our groups telling us what is really important that we might have missed to go through and have a development plan for the future. So people can be aware that when these galleries are done, first of all, it'll take you 4 visits to take in the broad scope of the full gallery. It is 12,500 square feet? It's a little under that. And so that is a lot of space. And there are a lot of stories and a lot of, I think we've got 850 artifacts in there. But you'll have to visit frequently because to get through all those and then to catch us as we are doing some sneaky updates. If you want to be aware of what those updates were, you have to come back and see us regularly. So
right. And we definitely looking forward with some anticipation of feedback from visitors, people as they come in and look and give us some feedback, and that will guide a lot of our efforts is responses to the stories that we've decided to tell and the ways in which we've told it. So well, gentlemen, Dan, David, thanks for joining me again on History 605. Look forward to getting through 2026. A lot of big events with America's 250th birthday and the exhibit for that, and then also completing the museum by the end of the year. So we got to get back to work.
But thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.